Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science only funnier. And today, ladies and gentlemen, is one of our rare, well, not always that rare. We used to do them a lot when Bill Hunt was around. And for those of you that are big fans of Bill Hunt, he's got some visitor from a startup company that does interesting acoustical technology for pickups on acoustic guitars. And that person is actually going to be a guest on the show coming up, hopefully in the next month or two, and Bill's going to be on the air. So that's why Bill can't join us. I did invite him to join us, but like I said, he's talking to a gentleman who's going to make a very interesting guest down the road here on Inside the Black Box. We had another one. What do we call this, Austin? The liner disappeared day?
I guess so, yeah.
So
not showing up in automation.
Every once in a while, the I guess it's a directory with all these liners in it, including our disclaimer here on the Inside the Black Box. This has happened to Trent before. Just disappears. So let me remind everyone that the opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not necessarily reflect those of WREK Atlanta or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Now that we got that out of the way, we can go completely hog wild and encourage anyone who's listening live this Wednesday, noon to one, to give us a call here in the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. So many times in the past, we have talked about, college orientation, what the college experience is like, how we do technical science and engineering education and things like that. I had a rather rare opportunity. I got to sit through the FACET freshman orientation here at Georgia Tech, partly because that's part of my new job as the director of the Center for Academic Enrichment. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what that means. But hopefully it's relevant to enriching the educational experience here at Georgia Tech. But the other reason I did it is because my daughter was going through that very same FACET session. And FACET is a good example of acronym overload. So do you know what FACET stands for?
Something? I should. I actually interviewed to be a FACET leader. I'm a current student right now, and I do not know what it is.
Freshman something.
Academic?
Freshman's acclimation to the surroundings and environs at Tech or something like that.
That's a tough one to remember.
Environs. And that is way overkill on an acronym. Nobody wants to put that in an acronym. And it really illustrates the fact that we're a little bit geeky. The kids in general, not so much. I don't think we're reaching them, right? Why did you want to be a FACET volunteer, a FACET leader?
Well, it's an opportunity to be a first impression for a lot of these students coming in.
It's
an opportunity to really just share what the school's about, I feel like.
Okay.
Me going to school here, and I'm going into my fourth year. I have a lot of knowledge and things I can share with these people.
Okay. At no time the thought of meeting freshman girls entered your mind.
I mean, I don't know. I don't know that I would date a freshman girl, honestly. I think I'd probably wait a couple semesters
let
them mature.
A little immature. Okay, I think freshmen in general. We don't mean that as a disparaging comment against women. In fact, I think of the freshmen, the women are the mature ones.
Right.
I was barely housebroken when I was a freshman in college. But I will say this. So I sort of hung around and you know what, like old skulky stalker guy. I mean, I explained who I was and why I was sort of sitting in on some of the student-led sessions. The students actually did a pretty good job. They led discussion groups, answered questions, and the two groups I sat in were excellent. Frankly, the best presentation was the traditions. They had two students present about traditions, and I did not know where the tradition of To Hell with Georgia came from, and it came out of some slur written on a rickety old dorm here at Georgia Tech back when we played our first game against the University of Georgia in football and were kicking their butts. But they were so angry at us, because we were sort of a relatively new team, that during the fourth quarter, the fans were like throwing stones and dirt at us.
Wow.
They actually had to leave before the end of the first quarter. So they never completed the first game. And, you know, they were all sort of, you know, beaten up by being clobbered with stones and dirt clods. And then on the way back, their train, so I think it rear-ended a freight train. So the football team actually got off and hopped the freight train back to Atlanta. And the newspaper person who wrote the story on it referred to them as Rex rambling to the next, something like that. So that's where Ramblin' Wreck came from. And they were so angry they wrote To Hell with Georgia on their dormitory wall or roof or something like that. But here's the thing I did not know. And is this the great secret? Am I going to give away something that parents and administrators and faculty do not know? They teach them the traditions, and they teach them that if someone says, what's a good word, you say, to hell with Georgia, right? And that's the, people say that at football games. It's all over the place. And by the way, we shouldn't apologize for that, because we have one of the single best-known fight songs on the planet.
Really?
There are people, I've had friends go to China and Africa and the Middle East, and they'll go, oh, you're from Georgia Tech, and the only thing they know is hell of an engineer and that stuff. So they know that. Wow. So. And, you know, to hell with Georgia, I drink my whiskey clear. Apparently, we're a bunch of alcoholic troublemakers, if you believe that thing. So it's also one of the most politically incorrect songs. But it's a great tradition. I think it's great. They told them the to hell with Georgia tradition. But then they, what did they do? They taught them that when someone says, how about them dogs, you're supposed to say piss on them. And that's a direct quote. So hopefully the FCC will get off my back on that one. FCC violations are all context dependent. That is relevant to the context. Really? Was that? I didn't even know that was a tradition.
Yeah, that's
so people
thing.
Say that all the time.
Oh yeah.
So basically, we think so little of our colleagues in the rest of the university system of Georgia in Athens, Georgia, that we would simply wish upon them a direct urinary assault. I don't know. I don't know. I mean, do you have friends at Georgia? Do the students see this as a really big rivalry? Do they?
I was surprised coming in freshman year when I did. Is it called convocation? Is that the first thing? Big ceremony?
It's the freshman. It might be the convocation.
I think that's what it's called. Convocation, where they were in what's now known as McCamish Pavilion,
right?
And had all the rat caps and stuff like that. Even like the president of the college, he was pushing to hell with Georgia and all those things. I think it's, they try to push the rivalry because it's a fun thing.
Okay.
I think the administration kind of pushes it too, because it's a fun, I think it makes games more interesting.
And they made some jokes, and my boss, Colin Potts, who was the first speaker at this thing, and I thought he did pretty well, actually, and I'm not just saying that because I start to work for him next Monday. You know, he had a couple jokes. He spoke from the heart. It was very sincere. Not all of the staff and faculty speakers were all that good. I mean, some of this thing, it's just the students were like, get me out of here. You saw them like, you know, trying to stab themselves with a small pen or something just to put themselves out of their misery. He was very careful about Georgia jokes, because he said he took a couple little digs, but he realized there are a lot of parents in the audience that went to the University of Georgia.
Oh, yeah.
Truth be told, the faculty, we just kind of laugh at that. If Georgia Tech wins, I will rub it into my neighbors and some friends and some colleagues over there for a couple of days. And if Georgia Tech loses, they'll do the same thing to me. And then we're done. But truth be told, academically, University of Georgia is significantly increased in its academic rankings in the last 10 or 20 years. They have some guys over there, and I've said this before on the radio, in medicinal chemistry, physics, computational quantum chemistry. They have one of the biggest names, Fritz Schaefer, over there. And he was the PhD advisor to one of our chemistry professors, who does some great stuff. He's a really great guy, David. And he's been on the program before talking about chemistry. So, you know, we're all about, you know, these are our potential collaborators. We send them students. They send us students. They don't work so much in engineering, except for sort of agricultural engineering. And now they have a biological engineering group related to that. But they're, you know, the football thing is, you know, once a year, and we laugh about it for 2 days. And that's basically it. But I was just shocked that they would actively solicit the activity of forced urination in the direction of our... I just thought that was absolutely nuts. And maybe what we're talking about now is... And this is something we've talked about on this program several times before, is the importance of the narrative. And maybe what you like about FACET, what you like about the traditions, is the fact that we're not sitting there throwing down... You know, here's the facts. You know, in 1898, we did this, and we played football, and then somebody wrote this, and then we did that. It's the story. And the story puts it in context, you know, helps you remember it, because I think that's how our brain remembers. It remembers things contextually. And it's just kind of interesting or entertaining. You can't drink out of a fire hose. So if you're trying to impart knowledge to someone, The knowledge you can remember the best is the knowledge that either you got for yourself or you saw how it came out of something and developed contextually. And that's, I guess, something I've been thinking about for this. I think it's the 120th meeting of the American Society of Engineering Education. It was here in Atlanta. It was a fabulous meeting. For those of you walking around Atlanta, seeing all these dorky nerds near the... the CNN Center and the Omni Hotel and the Georgia World Congress Center. No, it's not Labor Day. It's not Dragon Con. It's just a bunch of engineering educators. I did a couple gigs there and gave out a lot of pocket protectors, so maybe that might have confused you.
Oh, what a terrible Georgia Tech joke.
So are pocket protectors associated with Georgia Tech?
I dated a girl that was, her family were very, very big UGA fans. Both of her parents went to UGA.
Okay.
And I think her uncle, when he found out that she was dating a Georgia Tech student, and he's like, well, get ready for a life of, what do you say? He said, like, pocket protectors and something else. Just call me a dork.
Oh, okay.
Just a joke like that. And
oh, cool.
So, yeah. I think
there's
some
association. We haven't done it in a while. And I'm out. Literally, I just had a friend of mine complete in Adobe Illustrator, the vector version of the art for my next pocket protector. Yeah, I make them. I'll bring in one for you. Huh. We usually give them to the guests. I just haven't done it in a while because I'm running out. But in any case, it's kind of confusing. And I've made this before. I've made this comparison before at an American Institute of Chemical Engineers meeting, that Dragon Con and any technical meeting are very, very similar. And if you think about it, whether it's the American Institute of Chemical Engineers, the American Society of Engineering Education, Dragon Con and that meeting, they're both big national meetings. They both have a lot of nerds, because there's a lot of nerds at Dragon Con, and they both have a lot of guys who think they're Darth Vader. The only difference is, and this is good for Dragon Con, is at least they wear the costume at Dragon Con. You don't see Darth Vader in a technical meeting until somebody gets cornered in an afternoon session with a very, very difficult question. And they suddenly panic. And the first thing they do is they pull out that laser pointer. They start waving around like some kind of Jedi lightsaber. So they're in the room going, and then, you know, they'll sort of look at the guy who asked the question, and they'll go Darth Vader on your ass. They'll do the voice. They'll be like, yes, Obi-Wan, your question is a good one, but you're a geek and your fly is open, so sit your ass down before you feel the sting of my Jedi laser pointer. And they really do get that way. I think that's a good metaphor for the way we behave. But no, it was the American Society of Engineering Education. And I think a lot of people don't realize that there are a lot of people out there thinking about the way engineers work. And we are in a revolution at this time. I mean, we are experiencing a significant amount of change in the way we teach in general, but certainly the way we teach technical people. It is of critical importance because the current Obama administration is very interested in retention of engineers, generating more engineers. We think this is critical to improving the economy. And that, of course, would be in the area of STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And, of course, we talked with Gil Weinberg a couple of weeks ago on STEAM, not science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, but science, technology, engineering, art, and mathematics. And we realized that art can benefit from science and engineering in the form of the projects he talked about, robotic musicians and things like that from the Center for Music and Technology. And I think probably the reverse, a little bit about art. You know, humor, improv, things like that can improve your speech craft for when you're communicating to people. This is why Chyrna Halpern was sent to the Large Hadron Collider to teach them improv. Chyrna Halpern is a pioneer in the form of humorous improv. She's worked with Second City and a lot of big names in the field. And she sent them there, and I didn't quite understand this. This was an article published a couple of years ago in the New York Times, to teach them improv to help them better communicate to normal people. That normal people we would define here as someone who doesn't know the difference between a lepton and a hadron, so these light and heavy fundamental particles. And at first I thought, well, that just seems goofy, because I teach a living learning community on this, and I thought, you know, I could see how humor helps innovation, but I didn't really see how it helps communication so much until I was at Facet training, and I hadn't even started this job, and Colin Potts was talking, and Nirmal Trivedi, who's in charge of the GT1000 program, and the and the freshman reading this summer was talking, and they asked me if I wanted to get up and say a few words. And I realized that if you do improv, it makes you much more comfortable at speaking off the cuff when someone just asks you with a moment's notice. So we get to use words like it improves speechcraft. People like speechcraft. It sounds serious, like it's helping your communication skills. Mm-hmm. Whereas yakking, you know, off the cuff, like we're doing now on the radio, you know, that doesn't gender respect. And gender mm-hmm. respect, that's, well, you're just goofing around, things like that. So very interesting. One of the sessions I sat in on the American Society of Engineering Education was on entrepreneurial activities and entrepreneurial education. And we do this at Georgia Tech. They do a lot of this out at Stanford. They're very good at that. And a lot of different schools, small schools and big schools across the country, is literally having classes in entrepreneurship. It's not a new thing. I actually did my minor at MIT many, many years ago in entrepreneurship. And one of the courses I took was literally you just sit down and you will create a company from scratch, from whole cloth, and write up the business plan for it. And the last version of your business plan is your final project, and that's it. That's mainly what they graded. So we've been doing this for a long time, and I think we've learned a lot of things. One of the very interesting talks was actually from some folks at Stanford, and we're going to try to have them on the program coming up. And had I not left my notes in my office, I would have the name of that person. But hopefully you're going to hear more about that later. Talked about the usefulness of storytelling in teaching entrepreneurship. Pause for laughter. And it seems just plain goofy that someone would actually think that way. But if you called it the narrative instead of storytelling, you might be able to get away with it. And if you realize the way people overcome obstacles to entrepreneurship, the way people develop the confidence to go out and do something as a project on their own, it's actually a good idea. And let's do this. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about exactly the point that we're trying to make and the importance of storytelling. And they did a nice interactive talk with the students. It was actually quite good, as goofy as it may sound. But also, since we are taking listener calls today, if you have a comment or question for us about any aspect of science or technology, and you're listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1, by all means, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier. Okay.
Whether it's rock, blues, electronic, hip-hop, R&B, or reggae, they all have one thing in common. You can hear them all during the Rock, Rhythm, and Roll Sound Block, Monday through Thursday from 1 to 6 p.m. and 1 to 5 p.m. on Fridays, only at WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM.
Here on WRAK Atlanta, 91.1 FM, we fill our weekend with diverse music from all over. Blues, reggae, jazz, classical, folk, world, and plenty of music that's simply unclassifiable. Tune in to the Weekend Cornucopia on Saturday and Sunday to hear quality, diverse music that you don't hear on the radio.
The Soul Genius Hour of Science. Have you ever wondered about your neighbors? Maybe wondered about the weird thumps and bumps or chants emanating from their apartment? Well, they may be followers of Bob.
Well, here's a deal you might not want to miss. Salvation or triple your money back.
Bob Dogs came to town to set you free!
Reverend Ivan Stang says he'll offer an immense cash prize to anyone who can prove that Bob Dobbs is just a piece of clip art.
Now, at last, the step-by-step process is revealed. This is it, the only faith that promises action, thrills, success in sex and business.
Bob is great.
The Sub-Genius Hour of Slack. Saturdays at midnight. WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM.
Repent! Quit your job! Slack off! And pray for!
That was fantastic.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're doing a listener call-in show. So if you're listening to us live Wednesdays, noon to 1, give us a call here at the studio with any comment, question on any issue related to science and technology at 404-894-2468. Once again, that number, 404-894-2468. So just before the break, we were talking about an interesting talk I saw this week at the American Society of Engineering Education. It talked about the importance of storytelling in classes on entrepreneurship. And it literally forced students to give this narrative, and I'm going to use the narrative because the narrative belongs in those list of power buzzwords that we use in academic proposals and academic descriptions, but they're not necessarily the appropriate apropos vernacular for describing what it is. But it really is storytelling. And the storytelling accomplishes a number of things in this particular entrepreneurship course, if I remember it correctly. And that is, one, it talks about the process. And those that, let me think about it this, if you've ever started a small business and you belong to what's called a either a networking group or a leads group, right? This is a group of guys that get together once a week or so. And by guys, I mean that in the unisex term. And they'll trade leads from different businesses. So maybe one guy is an alarm company. The other guy's a realtor. And in fact, I found my alarm company guy through my friend who was a realtor through exactly this sort of thing. And these are folks that get together and they refer leads. So maybe you're a realtor and the guy's about to move in and he says, you know, if you want to put a new alarm in, I know someone who's really good. I'll refer you to him, which is really good. But what you have is a litany of failure, right? You start with ideas and it's horrible and then you fix it and it gets better. And then someone says, well, what about this? And then you test it in front of a small focus group and they say, this is crap and things like that. And it is very difficult to simply have someone give you a PowerPoint presentation and say, yes, you'll fail many times. It's much better to get that through the narrative of someone telling you about their failures, what they learned, how they regrouped, how they, you know, still felt confident that they could do something with this or something related. And another thing I've learned is that when you have this by the plenary speaker, right, the guy who was the CEO of Westinghouse or some giant company, I actually saw a guy speak on this, students do not believe that guy because he is sort of outside their domain. They think, well, this person's really successful. I'm different than that. So truth be told, they would rather hear that from a student, right? It actually makes them feel better about it. The other thing they learn is, and this is what we've noticed at Georgia Tech among engineers, they think their personal experience, their personal observation, their personal interpretation to decide how to tweak a design is bad. They think it's worthless, and unless it's in some, you know, nonlinear correlation in a textbook, they can't go in and say, well, I estimate this volume's about this, and let me look up and see some similar things. And they're all about, you know, 10 liters plus or minus 2%. So I'm going to go with that as a guess. You guys do not have the confidence to realize that your guess is as good as anyone else's. And when you get out there, you need to make guesses. And you need to make guesses because of something called comfort with uncertainty and ambiguity. That's something that has to do with open-end design that we'll talk about in a second. Did Austin, did you actually get a, did we get a caller calling in?
Yes, we did. He did not ask to be on air, but he was talking about just how we were discussing orientation. Oh. And he was asking,
is this a Georgia Tech student?
It was not a Georgia Tech student. And I'm not sure what his affiliation with Tech was.
But that's okay. It doesn't matter.
He was talking about that this is, he believes this is the 50th anniversary of desegregation at our college, and he was wondering what being an orientation, what kind of outreach are we doing to these different minorities?
Yeah.
And what methods of outreach have been effective with our students?
Was this one of our regular listeners, Paul? Was this Paul called up?
You know, it does not say on our caller ID.
No, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
So,
I did not catch his
Paul's
name.
One of our regular listeners. We love for Paul to come in. Paul asks great questions, but they always have sort of a little social and a political bent, mm-hmm. which is great because science and technology does not exist in a vacuum. And maybe that's an interesting question. The folks in the library, if Charlie Bennett were here, he could probably tell us. The library does these exhibits on these things, and that sounds like it may be right. And that is very relevant considering that just yesterday, the Supreme Court sort of stabbed a sharp, short dagger into the Voting Rights Act, which is really something designed to empower minorities that were excluded from the democratic process via this very same discrimination. So, gosh, what do we do at Georgia Tech to do that? I think we do as much or more than any sort of place. The normal facet and Connect with Tech is, I think, a very open, very diverse group. We have a diverse group of students that talk to people, but we actually have specialty versions of these. They're not always called facet. My daughter went through one for minority folks going into engineering, or it might have been science and engineering. And she was there because she was a woman. So they were specifically targeting women. They were also targeting, this one was targeting Hispanic students, but we have similar sorts of things through the Office of Minority Education for African-American students and other demographics. So the way we do it is we have special versions of this very thing. That's how we do it. Are they working? Yes. Are they working as well or better than any other university out there? I think absolutely. I think the problem is that society changes more slowly than a bunch of liberal, hippie, egg-headed academics who say, by golly, we should have diversity and a diversity coordinator and diversity programs. We can have all the diversity programs we want, but the world in various pockets is still run by old white guys. And as an old white guy, I will cop to that. That's still going to take a while. And I don't think Georgia Tech is particularly guilty of that. I think we actually are ahead of the curve. But I think society needs to get away from that old white guy thing. And I'm gonna point to Congress on this one. You got a hearing about something relevant to a minority demographic. Let's pick on women and you know, access to birth control. Don't put six white guys on it, or six guys, five of them are white. This is good. That's just not good. I think that's irrelevant. So the answer to your question, the way Georgia Tech does it, is we have specialty versions of these orientation programs. And I think the orientation program was very inclusive. They had a wide variety of folks up there doing sorts of things. Did they have another question, or was basically it?
No, I was just going to mention, I know this past spring, I believe it was, mm-hmm. Georgia Tech put on an event for international students or people that mm-hmm. Aren't familiar with a lot of our traditions.
Right.
They had pretty much a football 101
cool.
deal going on, cool. to where students that didn't know much about American football, they yeah. had an opportunity to learn
right.
a lot.
Right, because one of our great traditions is you go to the games and you root for the team and... You know, so and you know, we belittle that. You know, a lot of people, and I will say this, that many of my colleagues that are having to research, not all of them, but some of them, refer to that as the touchy-feely sort of thing. But having finished my graduate degree when my advisor moved from Boston to Zurich, Switzerland, that's extremely important to embrace the culture and learn about these things. Ironically, Zurich, Switzerland had I guess it was an amateur league. No, it might have been semi-pro version of American football. So they actually had the guys out there in their helmets some days, giving out flyers and things like that. I thought that was really kind of cool. Of course, what you learn about is international European football when you're over there. But you'd be amazed at what you learn. I learned that Switzerland has a shortage of nurses and other medical support professionals, in particular dental hygienists. So they're always trying to recruit them. They don't have a lot of schools on this there, so they were trying to recruit them from the United States and other countries. And basically, I learned when I went to the dentist over there that 90% of all the dental hygienists are Americans. And they just recruit them over there, and they're in high demand, so they probably pay them well. And I was talking German to my dental hygienist once, and she just looked at me and said, I speak English. I'm like, okay, well, that's convenient. And then she told me about these really cool embassy parties that me and the other graduate students are thinking, hey, we should go over to the embassy parties and meet some dental hygienists and things like that. I think that's extremely important. So that's really, really good. The funniest story I heard about cultural assimilation of a foreign student happened in my friend Cliff Henderson's group. It was a postdoc by the name of Richard Lawson. And he was talking and or friends with or interacting with these two Indian students, right? So they'd come over here from India. And he asked them what they did on the weekends, right? I mean, when I was in Switzerland, I did a lot of hiking. That's what people do. It's great. You take a train for 30 minutes, you're at a mountain, and you can go hiking. It's fabulous. And then they have this nice restaurant on the top of the mountain where you can go up there and hike up and eat breakfast and then take the train down. So it's a great place to hike. They got glaciers and everything. So he asked these students what they were doing. And what they did was go to NASCAR events on the weekend. So they go to Road Atlanta and things like that. And he said, really? You go to NASCAR? Okay, am I wrong? Does that seem a little strange?
Yeah, that's pretty strange. Yeah. I don't know who besides a white American would be interested in NASCAR.
Yeah, okay. But no, but the story gets really good. And that is that they would go to NASCAR events, and he asked them what they liked about NASCAR. And what they liked is the party, the drinking, the eating, the food, the jumping around, the having a good time with all these people they met. So they like the carnival atmosphere, which is true, right? If you're in the infield at one of these big events, right? I don't go to NASCAR, but, you know, you see this stuff. It's got to be a party time. It's got to be like tailgating palooza. And I think academics, we get a little snobby in saying, well, we don't want to sit there and eat brats and things like that. But I'm from Chicago, and that's what you're doing in the parking lot outside of Soldier Field. I mean, it's a very egalitarian society. I think it's great. So that's what they like. So the postdoc, Richard Lawson, said, you know, what you like is the carnival thing. So that's what you should find. You should find fairs and street fairs and places where you can drink and eat and party and things like that. They just happen to find NASCAR, and if NASCAR is part of their experience and they love it, I say more power to them. Probably the other weird thing I saw, and I'm going to say weird, and I mean that in only the most affectionate way, is we are desperate people. We are truly desperate in trying to engage students. And I'm going to go on record as saying this as part of my new job, which is in part to engage students and to improve. At least this is what Colin Potts is telling me. And we've sat in with some students and addressed this before. Faculty-student interaction. And faculty-student interaction is tough, and engaging students is tough. So there were some folks from the University of Connecticut that actually tried the gamification of the Senior Capstone Chemical Engineering Laboratory. This is the laboratory where you do work on big distillation columns and liquid-liquid extractors and reactors and all the different components that are in a large refinery or petrochemical plant. And you take measurements and you see how they're behaving and you try to fine-tune their operating conditions to make them work better or at least understand why they're not working at their optimum. And this is inherently a group effort. So you typically have a lab group that's working together, and there's various components. There's the lab and the lab write-up and the communication in the lab. Most people give an oral presentation. There may be some auxiliary homeworks or exercises or tests or things like that, but it is a group effort. And this guy actually took, I want to say, the equivalent of World of Warcraft guilds, because he used the word guild in putting people together, to generate this sort of collaborative interaction and learning. And to be honest, my son, Dylan, who plays World of Warcraft all the time, he loves this guild collaboration. And these kids really collaborate to an end goal. Their end goal is to win the fight or the war. I forget what it's called. Is it a raid? I think it's called a raid. If I'm wrong about that, give us a call. But their goal was to, you know, optimize the learning or the amount of understanding or the writing of the lab report or things like that. And in general, it's tough to tease out whether or not that fundamentally made people's scores better. I don't think the scores were statistically significant, but the impression of the lab was much better. People, their experience was better. They didn't feel that it was boring and horrible and unengaging and things like that. And that may just be a start. You know, what you might think of as silly gamification of these things may only be at the start, but at least it's helping us learn how to actually make these things work. The other thing we learned from one of the award-winning papers that was presented at the American Society of Engineering Education, and people have suggested this for many, many years, is lab manuals are bad. You know, we give someone and say, do this procedure, turn this on, start this up, this sort of thing. And much of the time we do that for safety reasons. But when you do a lab, you should not do it that way. And the author of the paper admitted that, you know, I go in a lab, electrical engineering circuit lab, chemistry lab, whatever it is, and you're in there and you're looking at this stuff and you're confused and you speed read the manual because you should have read it the night before, but you didn't, and then you sort of go through the motions. You have no idea what you're doing. You have no idea why you're doing it. And you have no idea of the significance of these things. Whereas, and other schools do this, by the way. This is something we've looked into at Georgia Tech. They're just like, here's a description of how to run the equipment. Figure something out. Characterize how it works. Does it work well? Or they give you a very high-level objective and just let you at it. And that's it. And that's the way labs actually should be done, because that's the way real-world life works. So that was articulated in one of these papers. And these guys had some great experience with basically an introductory chemistry lab. Do we have another caller?
We do not. She was asking... I should ask her if she wanted to get on air, but she was asking about opportunities at the radio station. So it's kind of unrelated.
Okay.
But what you were just discussing, I'm currently in the circuits lab.
Okay, this is in electrical engineering, electrical and computer engineering, right?
Right, and I'm experiencing that too. We have a lab manual, and actually I find it pretty useful to some extent. It has a lot of theory and then the procedure section.
Right.
And so I have to read last lab's stuff that we did in lab, and I'm quizzed over that and the theory for the upcoming lab that I have.
Yeah.
And so that's an example of a lab manual. And
that's the importance of a pre-lab.
Okay, right.
And pre-labs are something we do, and they did stress the importance of a pre-lab so that you're not just reading the thing. And our students could grade it on it. Otherwise, they would do what a lot of us do, is read it the last minute. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I do that for sure. Actually, after this show, I'll be cramming for the quiz.
Okay, but the point is, you're doing that reading before you're actually in the lab.
Right.
And, you know, doing well or poorly in the quiz will highlight shortcomings that you need to understand and things like that. Mm-hmm. So, but how's it working out? Do you like the circuit?
I think it's interesting. I think, obviously, there's no perfect lab manual.
Right.
And sometimes it's hard to understand based off of the procedures that we do, what it's trying to teach us.
Right.
It tells us what to do, but it doesn't tell us why we did it or what we're supposed to learn from it.
Right. And I think if you have to come up with the what, you have to know the why before you do the what.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of people are very afraid of this sort of thing because it's not a classroom. It's not a 1-hour lecture or a 3-hour lab period. It's this open learning environment. Many people now experiment with, and granted, these are at small liberal arts schools that I have visited in the past, just open labs, completely open labs, where you go in and you can check out your materials and you can work on it for 2 hours or 3 hours. And if you can't get it, you can come back later that night. And it's staffed by graduate student TAs, and they're making sure your safety goggles and reasonable stuff. We can't just leave it completely open because that is a liability nightmare. But that's maybe the sort of thing that you actually ought to do, sort of an entrepreneurial kind of approach to these things. But I think what we're learning is the classroom is dead. And I can't believe the plenary speaker on Tuesday, and if I had my notes, I could tell you who that is. It's the CEO of CorpU. And he coined an interesting phrase for me that I had never heard before. You've heard of the chief operating officer, the chief executive officer, sometimes the chief technology officer.
That's chief a relatively financial new one. Officer.
Chief financial officer, that's been around for a long time. But the chief technology officer, that's maybe only 20 years old.
Mm-hmm.
He coined a phrase that I'd never heard before, the chief learning officer. And this is the person responsible for all the protocols for training, updating of training, influx of knowledge. Do they collaborate with an academic group? Do they hire a consultant? Do they buy it as online courses on the web to train their people, right? You have lots more options now to do that. And the one thing that he pointed out to me that is very, very illustrative, and I don't know if he was the first one to say it. I suspect not, but it was very insightful when I learned it. He called it the version 1.0 problem. And so we've all used the 1.0 version of software. In fact, we all try to avoid the 1.0 version of software because we realize that's the one that doesn't have the kinks worked out of it. And usually the 2.0, 3.0 is usually the best version. And then it can even get better from there or might get worse. But certainly the 1.0 is not good. And he illustrated that the version 1.0 of any disruptive technology is that it uses the new technology in the paradigm of the old technology. And the examples he gave were great, that when you first when we first had film, we filmed plays. And that actually is useful. So if you've never seen a play, watching the film of a great play is a great thing. But it doesn't come close to exploiting the new opportunities associated with film, right? With film, you can, you know, take a you know, shoot a scene and then change it and move it and shoot a scene several times over. They'll do several takes and take the best part. You can merge them together. You can put in special effects, lighting effects, all that sort of stuff. So now we've taken what used to be film, and now we do it digitally. Digitally, the sky's the limit, right? I mean, our computers are so fast that computer-generated graphics, we could generate any bizarro imaginary world, right? So Avatar is a good example of that. Mm-hmm. Why even have the actors moving? Why not have the actors literally as, I mean, they're just sort of skeletal metrics or something like that. Planet of the Apes was the same way. I mean, they put little extensions on their arms to make their arms approximately right, and then they just CGI'd over the whole thing. But you had actors that would bring emotion and passion to the movement, and then you turn them into either a blue creature from another planet or a gorilla or a chimpanzee or things like that. He mentioned that the first things we put on TV were basically old radio plays, which was not the thing to do. But that's all we had. We had that ready to go, so you put them on there,
right.
And then people... I mean, this is like watching here, you know, a radio station, people sit behind a mic yakking. It's boring as hell. But then they learn from it and things like that. So now we have all this fancy stuff, high-definition video, high-definition, telecommunication. We can put anything on a computer and have you access it anytime, anywhere in the world. And there are still some people that take that high definition video and shoot a 1 hour boring old paradigm lecture and put it out there. And that is just wrong. People argue about the best way to do it. But basically the paradigm shift is we need to find the new learning environment in which this stuff works. It is not the classroom. It's not. And never have I been more convinced of that. And you hear a lot of terms out there, things that we're actually going to experiment with in the Center for Academic Enrichment is flipping the classroom. Face-to-face time is very, very important. By the way, that was the conclusion of one of our themes. I went to an open mic, believe it or not. Went to an open mic on chemical engineering teaching methodologies, and Daniel Liebig from Cooper Union hosted this and did an excellent job. But he was paranoid that no one would show up and no one would make any contributions. So he started, and he gave a few remarks about areas of technology that may be fruitful and perhaps we should consider these, give a very nice intro. And then you start real slow, and you're like, well, these guys just waiting to go to lunch or what? And then the floodgates open, and these people went nuts, and they talked about all sort of different technologies and things like that. And it eventually coalesced on students cheat like nobody's business. And the new technology allows them to do it.
Right.
So the key is, and here again, we need to redefine what cheating is and we need to redefine what collaboration is. Do you get that a lot?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
They tell you what is permissible and what is not permissible collaboration, right?
Well, as an engineer, I hardly have any classes where I would be working by myself.
Oh, good for you, because you shouldn't.
Right. And I think collaboration is a huge part of it, because you get stuck, and having somebody else's different perspective helps, as long as you're the one learning what... When they tell you how to do it, you're the one learning how to do it.
Yeah.
And I think that goes for looking for solutions to problems online as well. Because like you're saying, technology is a way to get answers. Yeah. Sometimes it's cheating, sometimes it could help you learn it.
So, I mean, what we call online, we used to call looking in the literature. And in the last part of the show, we'll actually talk about how that impacts citizen scientists. Now, you click on Google or Bing or whatever, and I'm not trying to push Google over Bing or anything else. I think Bing's out there trying to push the commercial nature of their better organized data that comes back. But I will say this, I found some really amazing stuff on Bing. So it doesn't matter what you use, but what I typically use is... you know, some nasty databases, the Chemical Abstract Service database, or Web of Science, which is all these Thomson Index journals in science and engineering. Medline works the same way for medical journals. But if you just literally click on the Scholar option of Google Scholar, you can find a lot of this stuff. Do you ever have courses where they say you can't go look at that?
I have not. Actually, I've had some that have their own specific software to encourage that.
Oh, cool.
While being monitored. And when I took physics, we had a software called Piazza.
Oh, Piazza, yeah. I used that for my class. Yeah.
And what that was the professor controlled it, and all the students could comment and ask questions, and and TAs and professors could give feedback, and students could as well.
Yeah.
But obviously, there's notifications to say, obviously, the professor's is more legitimate answer.
Is it really? Usually.
He's one that is in charge of grading.
Yeah, he's in charge of grades. You better believe the professor, I guess so. But not always. I mean, we know we've been successful, whether it's one of the other forums in the system we use here at Georgia Tech, which is based on Sakai, for those of you that might use it at other universities. We call it T-Square, but that's our version of it. Piazza is an add-on that my colleague Matthew Ralph turned me on to. I think that's it's a little easier to use. But yeah, we know we're doing well when students will answer each other's questions.
Right.
So, all right, we're at 12:47, so we should remind people that they're listening to WREK Atlanta. And let's take a quick break. And once again, remind you that if you do have a question or comment about any issue in science and technology, and you're listening to us live Wednesdays noon to 1, give us a call here at the studio at 404-894-2468. And when we come back, unless somebody calls, we will be talking about the concept of citizen scientists, which is something that's only going to increase in its importance over the years. We'll be right back with Inside the Black Box, science only funnier.
Listen to Psych Out every Wednesday evening at 11 here on WREK for the best psychedelic rock that the Atlanta airwaves have to offer. That's Psych Out, Wednesdays at 11 p.m. here on your home for mind-expanding, quality, diverse programming. WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM, Georgia Tech Student Radio.
Tune into Coffee and Sushi, Saturdays at 8 p.m., to hear an hour of smooth, down-tempo electronic music in a variety of styles. That's Saturdays at 8 p.m., only on WREK Atlanta.
The following is a public service announcement brought to you by the staff of WREK Atlanta. The average American uses 650 pounds of paper each year. 100 million tons of wood could be saved each year if that paper was recycled. You can keep our forest green. Visit keepatlantabeautiful.org to find out more information and to find a recycling center near you.
So, with regard to the former public service announcement, when I checked a couple of years ago, the single largest export from the United States, not by weight, but by volume, paper to be recycled. Most of it went to China, actually. So we do create a lot of that sort of thing. Probably the reason it goes to China is because China is really doing well in sort of the not so high value added commodity industrial production. Maybe it's because of their labor costs. Maybe it's because of their infrastructure to some degree. But they're recycling a lot of paper. We don't do a lot of paper over here. And people have said this before. This is not a new concept. Part of the reason why engineering education includes so much entrepreneurship education, as we mentioned before, is people have said we move from an industrial manufacturing economy to a service economy. I don't think that may be true, but I think it's irrelevant to the way our economy works. We have always been an innovation engine, mm-hmm. always, unless you can innovate and do new things. For example, the paper we make here is the high value added stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Fancy coated papers, papers that are used in sort of press board things, these high tensile strength boxes, things like that. My colleague, Victor Breedfeld, along with some of his colleagues over in the School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering, I think he may be working with Dennis Hess, another colleague of mine, and some folks in other schools here at Georgia Tech, are working with the ultimate hydrophobic hydrophilic paper. And they started it by trying to reproduce the lotus effect. And the lotus effect is weird. It's a little hydrophobic. So when water gets on the surface of a lotus, and it has to do with coatings and, you know, there's like this powder coating and things on that, it wants to bead up. So that means it doesn't like the surface. It wants mm-hmm. to bead up. And then when it beads up, the water droplet will fall down and traverse the edges of the flower. And as it does that, it's like sort of a cleaner. It cleans it. So my understanding is the lotus effect is that lotus flowers are always very pretty. They're always very clean because water beads up and cleans them.
Mm-hmm.
And what these guys have done is very, very interesting. It's they've made a surface that's both hydrophobic and hydrophilic. It's hydrophobic so things bead up, but it's hydrophilic so the water stays there. And it actually sort of gets trapped, but it won't penetrate. So I think they're working on the ultimate waterproof paper. So you could actually get paper that could just get a little wet, wouldn't bother at all. Let's face it, wet paper is not a good thing to have.
Absolutely not.
So,
and there was a Daily Digest about that, wasn't there? Didn't they
feature that? Oh, yeah. It's a mm-hmm. great picture. Mm-hmm. It's a great picture. And in fact, his graduate student gave a talk in it, and I stole a joke for it. In fact, when I talk about the value of humor in science and technology, it's one of my examples. I said, you know, a little bit of humor provides a good metaphor. So, for example, the student was trying to explain a surface that water both loves and hates. And that's a weird phenomenon. It has to do with the leading and the sort of the leading and the receding contact angles. And he said, it's a lot like marriage. You love your wife, but sometimes you hate being there. And I'm not disparaging marriage because if my wife heard this, she'd kick my butt. But I, you know, I think that explains it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's that sort of generic sort of thing that might be the metaphor to help you get that. But citizen scientists, this is something I was actually talking with some folks about this morning. It's something we're planning on incorporating in a research proposal to enhance education. That, and this was the topic of the two humorous talks I gave basically at the meeting this week. We don't have a good rep out there as engineers, right? What we do is very, very important, right? We make life work. We enhance life. It's a good thing. But most people are like, engineers, these people are so boring. I don't care about engineering. We do not have a good branding. I mean, business acts like they run the whole show. Without mm-hmm. business, everything would fall apart. Mm-hmm. Well, it is important, but we don't have a good brand and we need to get out there. So what's interesting is one of the components of this proposal we're working on is the citizen scientist. And the citizen scientist is something that was much more prevalent maybe 100, 150 years ago. So Benjamin Franklin was like this, you know. He was a citizen, and he just used to do experiments for fun. And actually, he was extremely intelligent, so he probably transcended that definition. But the citizen scientist is the person who can't necessarily do the really high-energy, expensive, equipment-requiring stuff. But they can do some empirical work that finds amazing things.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the best examples of that is in agriculture. So there are all sorts of household products that don't require fancy, complicated chemicals. Many of them are surfactants, right? If you watch these gardening shows, everyone's shooting different soapy solutions on things. And soap is a surfactant. It has a part that likes water and a part that hates water. And that does interesting things to the membranes of cells, to the membranes of plant cells, to insects, right? So they actually use it as herbicides and pesticides and all sorts of things because different surfactants do different things to different organisms. And sometimes you find that empirically, and some gardener just finds it, and then this ends up in crops and things like that. That's where the citizen scientist really excels. And one of the topics that's very interesting to us here is the Urban Honeybee Project here at Georgia Tech. And unfortunately, we do not have an archive of this because I messed up the tape. But Jennifer Kraft Levy, who's our sort of, I want to say collaborative science coordinator, something like that. It's not collaborative, but she coordinates all this interdisciplinary science lab stuff, has started a program here called the Urban Honeybee Project here at Georgia Tech. And we also had Michael Goodisman on very recently, I think it was back in May, talking about colony collapse syndrome. And this is where you just lose the entire colony. They all get sick. It has to do with a particular mite that infects the colony. So what's interesting is my colleague Matthew Ralph, who was a former NSF program director, was telling me about a guy he went to a meeting with last week. And we're trying to obtain this paper. This guy works for BASF, a large chemical company. So he's a real scientist. So he could submit something to a journal and it would get published. But you should judge things based on the quality of the paper, not who submits it. Sometimes, the guys from Harvard, we better publish it, even though I don't understand it. I hope that doesn't happen very often, but it probably happens a bit. So he was getting his hair cut. And the guy that cuts his hair is a beekeeper, just like the guy from BASF. So they keep bees, and everybody worries about their hives sort of collapsing. It could be this colony collapse syndrome or something else. The bees get sick or they leave or the queen dies or all these sorts of things. And this guy was having problems with his hives. So he did what we can now do very easily. He went to the literature. He went to the literature from the last turn of the century. So early 20th, late 19th century, and found they had similar problems. Don't know if it had to do with these mites or not. Don't know if it was a different type of colony collapse syndrome. Don't even know if it was a different type of disease. But they empirically found this, and they reported on it, that if you can change the synchronization of the reproductive process, and you can do that by pulling out a queen and putting another queen in, and it literally will change sort of the timeline, mites or diseases or bacteria, whatever it is, probably can attack you at more or less vulnerable states. So whether it's the pupa or the whatever, you know, the different states of the bee, they might be more vulnerable at times. And if you can change the synchronization of that with whatever it is that it's affecting the hive, and I'm not doing service to this because we don't have the paper, then by sort of swapping out queens, you can defeat this. And that's what they found. And he had been having a problem. I don't know if it's the literal mite-based colony collapse disorder. From something almost 100 years ago, and then tried it in his hive, and his hive did much better and flourished and things like that. So they are writing a paper on this. And, of course, it's easy because the BASF guy, he's a PhD researcher. He knows where to submit and how to submit and how to write it, how to write it in the right jargon. Right jargon is the enemy of the citizen scientist. But here's a person who found a way to fix this problem. And we see these happen on a regular basis. And the thing is, now, citizen scientist movements should proliferate more than ever, because you can just go on a Google Scholar and not have to have a subscription to these journals and still find an amazing amount of the literature and do this very thing. And probably the best illustration of this, the best manifestation of this, is in what we call the maker communities. Do you belong to a maker community? Or these are the guys that they make beer. They make medieval weapons. They make horseshoes, whatever it is they make. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they're usually led by some local guys who might be experienced, might be craftsmen in this area. Mm-hmm. And then people want to learn how to shoe their own horses or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, beer is a very popular one.
Right.
And you have a whole community who's not motivated by publishing a paper on it. They're simply motivated on the fact that they're passionate about it, right? So let's take beer. It's easy to get passionate about beer. And they're mixing different types of hops and different types of yeast. I mean, you can go to these craft beer stores and buy all kinds of different yeast, some that are much more robust, so you can make higher alcohol beers. But for all we know, these guys might be breeding yeast or using different hops or putting blueberries in it or whatever it is, and they're finding amazing new things in these maker communities. And that is nothing short of being a citizen scientist. So I certainly hope that sort of thing continues. I asked my friend Matthew, I said, would the National Science Foundation fund this sort of thing as a former program director? And he said, you know, maybe not. Although some of their educational research does like that community outreach stuff. So maybe that's not necessarily true. But if you think about it, they're a little bit beholden to the academy, the nerds that do this sort of stuff. I hope they take a longer view on that. And let's face it, as government agencies go, with all its flaws in the National Science Foundation, they're based on relatively objective review compared to the rest of the government. The National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation, even with all their flaws, are doing a great job. So maybe that's something for them to consider. All right. So, well, we had one call, so that was good. I appreciate you tuning in for this sort of rambling listener call-in version of the show. But we've reached the end in the portion we like to call What Have We Learned? Well, what have we learned? We've learned that the folks who do engineering education research, who showed up and talked about it at the American Society of Engineering Education meeting right here in Atlanta this week, are doing some weird things to engage people. They're embracing the value of storytelling because it is through that narrative that we learn that, well, look, other students had difficulty getting their idea off the ground. Other students used their own personal perspectives to design and modify things. Maybe what comes out of my head isn't so bad either. Even crazy things like gamification. I mean, if it works for World of Warcraft, why can't we use it to engage people in Unit Operations Lab? The data from that out of University of Connecticut maybe isn't complete, but at least the students like it better. And for now, I'd at least celebrate that. It's not about different ways to teach in the classroom anymore. The classroom is dead. The classroom is a classic example of the version 1.0 phenomenon, namely that we have all this new technology that we can deliver and enhance education with. And what do? We jam it into the same old paradigm of a one-hour lecture in a classroom. That's going to stop, hopefully, if we understand how to circumvent this version 1.0 phenomenon. Improvements from diversity. One of our callers called up and asked, you know, how do we deal with orientation for different demographics? And that is handled via separate Connect with Tech and Facet sessions through the Office of Minority Education and things like that. And let me put a plug out for diversity. We always say that diversity is important because it's a moral imperative. And it is, I think. I think everyone has the same opportunity for this sort of thing. But diversity is important for another reason. And the other reason is diversity of viewpoint. So if you're in there in a class in engineering, entrepreneurship, you're designing something, it doesn't really matter what it is, and you're brainstorming and you're trying to come up with a new idea that is outside the box, that takes a paradigm shift that allows you to do this more efficiently with less energy. The more diverse attitudes you have, the better. I have experienced this firsthand in doing workshops on innovation. And there'll be something somebody comes up with that no one ever thought of because they're different. I think of very different things because I'm a middle-aged man who lives with my wife and she does, you know, puts weird things and floral potpourri in the bathroom or things like that. And other people live in dorms and fraternities. It's different. You have a different perspective. And if you come from a different country or a different demographic, it's extremely important. And then finally, the citizen scientist. This is something we're going to hear about a lot because of access to things like Google Scholar and the fact that we can access literature now like at no other time in history. And I certainly hope the Academy actually embraces this. Did we leave anything out? Hopefully not. All right. Well, if you have a question or comment about this show or a suggestion for a future show, by all means, send us an email at comments@insidetheblackbox.org. We want to thank Austin, who is now our permanent engineer. I haven't heard from Trent at all, but I hope he comes back just so we can go out and celebrate his new job in D.C. One of these days, we will actually get our theme music back up on the radio that is composed and performed by Bill and Mary Hunt. And just a reminder, we are a production of the WREK Studios here on the campus of the Georgia Institute of Technology. Please join us next week for Inside the Black Box, Science Only Funnier.